Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Muy buenos dias and muchas enchiladas, everybody. Welcome to the Patrick Madrid Show. Thank you for listening. You know me, I'm the most grateful guy around when it comes to you. I really appreciate you listening. Here's the number to call to be on the air. 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Cyrus, you know what day it is. You know what day it is because you, like I, have been getting bombarded from people all around the internet. National Crunchy Taco Day. I didn't know there was such a thing. Every day is a taco day as far as I'm concerned.
Right. It's like, what? So every day is National Crunchy Taco Day for us.
You know, it's interesting that crunchy tacos are kind of an American thing. At least it's more popular here in America. If you were to go down to Mexico, it's been a long time since I've been there, and the way things are going right now, it's kind of risky to go down there. But when I was down there, if you wanted a taco, you would not get a crunchy taco. They don't really tend to make those. They're soft corn tortillas. And they're good. Don't get me wrong. I love them. I'll tell you that. But
as soon as I found out it was National Crunchy Taco Day, I texted my wife and I was like, "Hey, it's National Crunchy Taco Day." And she's like, "Oh, that's cool. We're having tacos for dinner. But they'll be soft tacos."
That's okay though.
And I said, "No." No, I said, "I'm just fine with that. Any way you put some meat and some lettuce on a corn
Don't forget
or flour
the onions.
And the onions in the salsa." Mm-hmm. "Do you put cheese on your taco, Patrick?"
I do. So a typical taco at Rancho Madrid would be whatever the meat is that's going in there, and cilantro, finely chopped onions, white onions, by the way, I prefer. I mean, I'll take any onion, but I prefer white onions, and some salsa if we have it, and cheese if we have it.
Often now that's what I call a taco.
Yeah, it's good. Good stuff. So, and it's also a cheap meal. Growing up, man, we didn't have a lot of money in my family. We were kind of making ends meet. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. And so it was, you know, we didn't have a big budget for food, quite frankly. And so my mom did a great job. She really stretched the family food budget, which there wasn't much there to begin with. And so we ate lots, and I mean lots of Mexican food, tostadas, that was a very common thing in our house, which is, it's like a taco, but it's flat. You just take the tortilla, you fry it, and it's crispy. And then you slather the refried beans on top of that, whatever else you want. And man, did we eat a lot of those things growing up. I used to go to school, you know, that I went to the Mission San Juan Capistrano school for years. And again, not much money in the family food budget. So it was not uncommon to open my lunchbox and find that lunch, and it was good, it was delicious, but it was a large flour tortilla that had refried beans in it, rolled up like a taquito, but it was cold, and tasted great. Loved it. Stick to my ribs, that's for sure.
I like tacos.
Yeah. Who doesn't like tacos? I mean, come on.
We do it in Mexico all the time.
I know. Hey, speaking of moms and women, I have a little audio I want to play for you. This is Tulsi Gabbard. She used to be in Congress. She's not in Congress now. She identifies as kind of, I think she identifies primarily as Hindu, but she's also got a Christian background as well. So she's friendly to Christianity. And she talks a lot of sense. And she's talking here about how she regards the attempt to erase the category of women as being an expression of hatred and hostility from the people who really don't want to hear this idea that there are really just two sexes, male and female. I'll let her say it in her own words, but this is her giving a speech recently. Here's what she said.
We just celebrated International Women's Day last week.
I was scrolling through social media, seeing, you know, what are people saying about it? And you saw a lot of nice flowery words coming from a lot of people in Washington celebrating women and all the women have accomplished over the years and all these great inspiring examples of women leaders throughout our time. We know the hypocrisy there. You ask them what is a woman, and they can't answer the question. And one of the people they chose to honor in the White House on International Women's Day was not a woman at all. It was a biological male. There are two major points
here. Can we stop there for a second? I want to interject a thought. When I first heard this clip yesterday, I think it was, and I was thinking about what she's saying, and I agree with what she's saying, so don't mistake what I'm saying now as a disagreement. It's not. But I'm at the point now where I don't even want to hear or use the phrase biological male, because even just to say that, a biological male, it cedes some territory that I don't want to cede, and that is, and by the way, spelling here is important, C-E-D-E, C-E-D-E, not S-E-E-D. I don't want to cede the territory to those who would suggest, well, they insist that, you know, you can be a biological male, but you're really a female. The phrase biological male, to me, seems almost redundant now. You're male or female. Now, I'm not disagreeing with Tulsi Gabbard. I think she's spot on, as they say. But that's my contribution, a little footnote to what she's saying. Let's get back to her.
Number one is, there is no greater expression of hatred and hostility towards women than to try to erase our existence as a category of people and to minimize us to being a construct of anyone's imagination. And the second thing that doesn't get talked about often enough as we are looking at this insanity is that by rejecting the objective truth that there is such a thing as a woman, they are rejecting the existence of objective truth as a whole. And when we remove those boundaries of what is actually true and false, not my truth or your truth or their truth or whatever it is, that there is such a thing as objective truth, then we remove all the boundaries of our society and we end up in a position, what we're seeing right now, where what is declared as true is based on whatever those in power say that it is. And we've seen again how this changes over time.
Okay. We will post this. Cyrus will post this for you so that you can take a look at it and maybe share it with some people who might need to hear that. Now, alongside that, I want to share with you, this is from Piers Morgan, I believe. Is that right, Cyrus, this next one that we're going to listen to?
Yeah, this is Piers Morgan. He's talking with Richard Dawkins.
Yeah, Richard Dawkins, the famous British atheist. You know, he and I would probably not get, we would not agree on much of anything, Richard Dawkins and I. But even Richard Dawkins is not afraid to speak the truth on this issue. Keep in mind that Richard Dawkins is not a philosopher. He's a scientist. I think he's a zoologist, if I'm not mistaken. I have to double check. But in any case, he's coming at this question from the standpoint of science. And so here's his contribution with Piers Morgan talking about gender.
They want to, what they call, degender and neutralize language. But they're doing it from a completely false pretext that you can somehow pretend biology doesn't exist, particularly when it comes to someone's sex. I mean, it's incontrovertible. There's no scientific doubt about this. And yet a small group of people have been quite successful, actually, in reshaping vast swathes of the way society talks and is allowed to talk.
It's bullying. And we've seen the way J.K. Rowling has been bullied, Kathleen Stock has been bullied. They've stood up to it. But it's very upsetting the way this tiny minority of people has managed to capture the discourse and to really talk arrant nonsense.
What's the answer to it?
Science. I mean, there are two sexes. You can talk about gender if you wish, and that's a subjective.
When people say there are 100 genders, for example.
I'm not interested in that. As a biologist, there are two sexes, and that's all there is to it.
You had a humanist award stripped in 2021. Because of your comments about this kind of thing. You had a tweet in April of that year. In 2015, you tweeted, Rachel Dolezal, a white chapter president in America, the NAACP, was vilified for identifying as black. She was white. Some men choose to identify as women. Some women choose to identify as men. You'll be vilified if you deny that they are literally are what they identify as. Discuss. And all hell broke loose and you had your award stripped because you were effectively doing what J.K. Rowling and others have said. You were just espousing a biological fact.
I wasn't even doing that. I was asking people to discuss. Discuss. Mm. That's what I've done all my life in universities.
Right. Why have we lost that ability to actually have an open and frank debate?
There are people for whom the word discuss doesn't mean discuss. It means you've taken a position, which I hadn't. But anyway, I thought it was a reasonable thing to discuss. This was, on the one hand, I actually wrote a couple of follow-up articles to this. Race is actually a much more fluid concept than sex. For one thing, many people are of mixed race, so they really can be, you know...
Well, I had my DNA done, for example,
yes.
Properly tested. It came back, I had zero English DNA, zero. I actually have 6% Middle Eastern,
yes.
For example.
Yes.
Right? So that was a shock to me. I had no idea.
Yes.
A lot of Celt, a lot of Irish and Scottish and Welsh.
Yes.
But no English whatsoever.
Yes. Well, we're all mixed, and therefore it actually is a perfectly reasonable thing for somebody to identify as some particular race if they want to. But sex is not like that. Sex really is binary.
Mm.
And therefore it's something is certainly worth discussing that odd anomaly, which I pointed out in that tweet.
Yes, 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 yes. I can't really improve upon that. It's an undeniable truth that everybody nowadays wants to deny. We'll have those posted for you so you can share them. I'm open for business. Any topic you want to get into, here's the number, 888-914-9149. Let's go to Josh now in Maine. Hello, Josh.
Hello.
How old are you?
12.
All right. Welcome.
My question is, when I was playing basketball and one of my friends, he's not Catholic, and we were talking about the Eucharist, and he said that how, and he said, I was telling him we believe that it is the body and blood of Jesus Christ, and he, how he did in the Last Supper, but he said how Jesus used many metaphors, and I don't know, and how do you know that one's not a metaphor?
That's a great question. Well, I'm assuming the kid who said that is not Catholic, right? He probably is Christian, but not Catholic?
Yeah.
Okay. So from some Protestant group, chances are. Well, that's a good question that he's asking, and it's a good one for you to really know the answer to. It's important for Catholics in general to know the answer to these questions. So I would look at it this way. If you read the words of what Jesus said at the Last Supper, he says, with the bread in his hands, he says, "This is my body." And then with the chalice of wine, he says, "This is the cup of my blood." So the first clue would be, what did he say? Did he say, "This is going to be representing my body," or "This will remind you of my body and my blood," or "This will be a symbol of my body and blood"? I think the first clue is to just look at what he said, and he said, "This is my body." It's a very interesting way of putting it if he intended it to be a symbol. So the first thing you can think about is, well, if Jesus thought, if he was saying this in a way that was just a metaphor, he chose an unusual way to say that because he said it in a way that could be open to the possibility that he's saying it literally. But he said other things too. He says, "I am the vine and you are the branches." Now, obviously, there's a metaphor. He's not literally a plant. Or when he says, "I am the sheep gate," he's not literally a door with hinges on it that sheep would come and go through. So we do see Jesus using metaphors fairly frequently. But this one, the next step, it seems to me, is that we would have to say, all right, well, if we just look at the words on the page, it could be metaphorical. It could be literal. How can we know? Because we weren't there, obviously. So what about the people who were there? And that would be the 12 apostles, the disciples, as they're called here, but it was his inner circle of disciples. And they were there. So we could say they would have a clue, or a better clue at least, what did Jesus mean by this? Because they could talk to him. They probably asked him questions. He probably gave some more explanation than is what is recorded in Scripture. And they knew his body language and the tone of voice. So they had more to go on to understand what Jesus meant by this. So how do we know how these apostles understood it? Well, one thing we know is that St. Paul, who was not one of the 12 apostles, he was not a disciple of the Lord. He converted later, as you probably know. Well, in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, he tells us that he received the revelation directly from Jesus about what happened at the Last Supper. And he says exactly what we read in the Gospels about what Jesus said when he took the bread and said, "This is my body," and he took the chalice of blood and said, "This is my blood." So he wasn't there in person, but Jesus, he says, told him exactly what this was. So what's interesting about that is that's where, Josh, he talks about don't receive communion if you're in mortal sin. He says, do not receive if you're in the state of unworthiness. That's another way of saying serious sin. And he says, if you do that, then you are guilty of the body and the blood of the Lord. Guilty of murder, in other words. And he says, if you eat and drink without recognizing the body, you eat and drink judgment or damnation on yourself. So this is another clue. And that is that even though St. Paul wasn't there, he received directly from Jesus the meaning of what Jesus said. And so then you could test this theory about, is it just a metaphor by what St. Paul says? And I don't think that would work, because if it's just a metaphor, how can you be guilty of murder if all you're eating is just a piece of bread? I mean, if that's all it is, if it's just a symbol of Jesus, then how can you be guilty of murder? How can you eat or drink damnation on yourself if you don't recognize the body? And what are you recognizing in any case? If it's not really the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus, why would you be receiving a punishment for not believing that this is really him if it's not really him? One analogy, Josh, since we're talking about metaphors and analogy, imagine if you had a picture of somebody and you stabbed that picture, say like a life-size picture of that person, and you stabbed the picture. Well, it'd be weird, but you wouldn't go to jail or anything because you didn't technically break any laws. You're just doing something odd and weird, but you didn't do anything that is illegal. But if instead of the picture of the person, if it were really him and you actually stabbed the person, then you go to jail because you've committed murder. So even the language of what St. Paul says doesn't lend itself to the interpretation that it was just a metaphor. He too points us in the direction that this is literal. And then the third and final thing I'll mention, well, two more things, and I'll be brief because I have to take a break in a minute. The next thing would be, the people who knew the apostles learned about this from them. So here's a name that you can look up after we're done talking. Saint Ignatius of Antioch. Ignatius of Antioch. And he was a contemporary of the apostles. He was an old man when he was thrown to the lions. That was the way he was martyred, around the year 107. Quite elderly at that time. But he knew the Apostle John. He actually learned the faith. He learned the gospel from the Apostle John. And it seems he also knew St. Peter. So he knew two of the apostles, and he learned from them what it was that Jesus said and did and what he meant by what he said and did. And in his letters that he wrote on his way to Rome to be martyred, he talks about the Eucharist. And he talks about how the Eucharist is really the flesh of Jesus that suffered for our salvation. And he goes on at some length. He talks about it, and there's more there than I have time to quote to you right now. But he does also warn us. He says, if you meet somebody who doesn't profess what we believe, what we were taught by the apostles, then stay away from that person, because he's teaching something that didn't come from Jesus, didn't come from the apostles. So he's talking about the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist as something literal, not metaphorical. And then the last thing is, once you start looking at all of the existing records that we have from the early church, the comments made by the church fathers in the earliest centuries, you see that it's universally believed that the Eucharist is not merely a symbol, but that it's really the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus under the appearances of bread and wine. Now, they didn't use formulas like that, but they definitely believed it, and they taught it, and they defended it, and they were willing to die martyrs' deaths in some cases for that belief. So the great weight of evidence biblically, and we didn't even talk about John chapter 6, but all of the biblical evidence and certainly the evidence from those witnesses in the early years shows us that it's really unreasonable to an extreme to say that Jesus only meant that in a metaphorical way. He did mean it literally, and that's how the early Christians understood it. So that's how we can know with certitude 2,000 years later what Jesus meant. Does that make sense to you, Josh? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes.
Okay. It's a good question you're asking. I wish I had more time, but I've got to take a break. So what if we leave it there for now, and you call me back another time when your mom says it's okay, okay?
Oh, thank you, Patrick.
You're welcome. Thank you. Be right back. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. If you're in the market for health insurance, our sponsor, the Catholic Order of Foresters, is here to help you and your family find the most cost-effective plan. Learn more at relevantradio.com/forester.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
We do it in Mexico all the time. All the time. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Mariana in Chicago. Hi, Mariana. Did I catch you unprepared? I think I did.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Patrick, I have a question. I have a big concern. I've find out that my 22-year-old daughter... she's in college, and a few months ago, I've discovered that she's smoking weed.
Mm-hmm.
I've addressed the situation as respectful and loving possible. And a few months later, I've realized she continued doing it. So I addressed it again. My husband and I talked about it, and... well, she goes to school, doesn't work. We pay for all her expenses. We bought her a car a couple of years ago. So we decided to address it again and have her make a decision whether she would stop doing that or we will pull the card away. So we
card or car?
Car. A car.
Car. Okay, got it.
Car. Yeah.
Are you still paying for her cell phone?
We pay for all her expenses.
Mm. See, right there, I would say my advice for what it's worth, but I am, you know, I'm not an expert by any means, Mariana, but I mean, I've raised 11 kids and I've seen a few things. And one big thing for me is when they hit 18, that's it. They spin off. They have to pay for everything themselves. Car insurance, car payment, cell phone, you name it. And they have to learn how to do that. And what happens is, and we'll come back to the marijuana issue for sure, but one of the problems is that young people become entitled. They feel entitled. And they don't learn survival skills the way they would otherwise learn them if they had to sink or swim. Because if mom and dad are paying for everything, it just sets them up for a kind of laziness, a kind of, well, you know, they're going to take care of it anyway, so I don't really need to work as hard as I otherwise would. So as far as like underlying issues are concerned, I think it's personally, since you're calling for advice, I would say it's way past the point where you need to start withdrawing all of these financial supports because she doesn't really need them. And she would function, more in the real world if she had to hustle and, you know, maybe get a second job, if she had to work harder. That would be at least some of the advice I would give, is to try to wean her away from all that as fast as you can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I thought about that. But this confirms that we need to start doing that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, she was really upset and obviously frustrated.
She gets upset? She gets upset with you because you don't approve?
Yeah. And she was saying that, like, it's a big of a deal for us, which is not for her. And she's saying that she's probably desensitized. And I said, yes, because it's all over the place and everybody is doing it and it's becoming a norm. And here in Chicago, it's legal. Yeah. And for us, will never be legal. And it's not good. You're harming yourself. When you are under the influence, it really diminishes your judgment and your ability to make good choices. So we are worried about you, about the people you are hanging around with. So basically, you have to make a choice, or you stop doing that, or we're going to take the car away.
What did she say?
Well, she, after a conversation, I asked her to, she need to think about it and make a decision. Basically, I given her the choice. So she said that she felt that she was being punished. I said, well, you can take it the way you want it. It's not punishing you, but we need to make you wake up and realize that this is not right. We need to do something extreme. Right. And for us was taking the car away. Then later on, she came and said, I'm quitting.
Quitting
and I
what?
Said, you quitting what? And she said, well, smoking. And I said, OK. And that was it. But now I've since I addressed this issue months ago and she continued doing it despite what I said, I really don't trust that that is going to happen.
I understand where you're coming from. I totally do. And I feel your pain. Exactly. Let me share with you a couple thoughts. One is I have a buddy who has a son. I don't want to be too specific here, but I have a friend who has a son, young adult, who has a substance abuse problem. And because my friend is a tender-hearted father who pays for a lot of stuff for his young adult kids, he's like, you know, he owns the car that his son is using. So because he was so frustrated like you are right now, what he did was he purchased a device that is connected to the car that the son can't disable, that he has to blow into in order to make the car start. So he's got to breathalyze every single time he wants to drive his car that his father pays for, that he's got free use of. And if he blows with the chemical in his breath, the car won't start. And it won't start for like X number of hours. And the car is just disabled. It's a giant paperweight at that point. So he knows that he's got to get to work or he's got to get to wherever he wants to go. So that's a trade-off for him that if he... And there's also something about it too where it won't accept somebody else's breath. It has some way of knowing that it's really him. And I should ask my friend about it to find out what exactly what is it called, and I could share that. But that's one possibility. I bet if you did a little Googling, you'd find that. And you could say, okay, you know, trust but verify, as Ronald Reagan used to say. Trust but verify. And okay, if you're not smoking anymore, that's great. But we have a new device on the car that will just verify that fact. And if you want to drive the car, I don't think you should be paying for it in any case. But let's just say you kept doing that. If you want to drive the car, you have to blow chemical-free or the car won't start. And maybe that'll send her through the roof. Maybe she'll be even more angry about that. I don't know. But you're right, and your husband, you and your husband both are right. You should stand against this. This is bad for her. There's an article that I sent to somebody that I know recently about how daily marijuana use raises the risk of heart disease by 34%. And there's some people I know personally who dabble in marijuana, and so I'm not at all shy about texting them articles like this just to show them, hey, there's a lot more here than just what mom and dad think. You know, science tells you that this kind of thing is harming your body in many ways. So I would also give her, it's an inexpensive little book, but I would give her a book by Jesse Romero called 50 Reasons Why what is it called, Cyrus? 50 Reasons with What's Wrong with Marijuana. I think that's what it's called.
That's close.
What is Wrong with Marijuana? 50 Questions and Answers.
There that's it, is. It is.
Yeah. What is Wrong with Marijuana? 50 Questions and Answers. And Jesse's former law enforcement, so he has a lot of that world to draw upon. So he looks at this from a medical perspective, law perspective. I realize that it's legal where she lives now.
Where am I supposed to get it?
Well, look online. Go to your local Catholic bookstore. He has a website, it's jesseromero.com. You can find it there as well. But you know me, I like to promote helping your local Catholic bookstore first if you possibly can. But if you don't have one, you can check out his website, Mariana. I'm probably mispronouncing your name. Sorry about that. But that's what I would do. I would recommend you just stand your ground and begin withdrawing these unnecessary financial underwritings that you're doing with her. She doesn't need that. It's bad for her. In any case, that'd be my suggestion, and I'll leave it at that, but I hope that helps you a little bit, Mariana, and we'll get a link posted for that book so that you can see what it looks like if you want to go into your local Catholic bookstore and get
it. What do you say to people that are like, well, it's marijuana, it's not addictive. I could stop anytime.
Of course, yeah, I could stop anytime. Well, the thing that I don't have at my fingertips but is in this little book is like, what are some of the statistics about PCP and THD or THC or whatever the chemicals are in marijuana in its various forms? And among other things, that like when I was in high school, I graduated from high school in 1978, and there was marijuana everywhere. I mean, kids were smoking dope all over the place. It was very common. I mean, it was actually, I think a lot of people think today, oh, mom and dad, when you guys were in high school, nobody did that. Everybody did that in the 70s. There were a few of my teachers that I thought during the breaks, they probably snuck out back and did a doobie.
I was walking.
I never saw that, but I wouldn't be surprised if even that was happening.
I was walking through a mall or some kind of like a Target or something with my son. He was 16 at the time, and there was like this whiff of marijuana smoke.
Yeah.
And and he's like, oh, that's weed. And I'm like, how do you know what that smells like? And he's like, Dad, I go to a public high school.
Yeah, everybody's doing it. Yeah, no, I know what you mean. And the reason I mention it is because I'm sure that some kids nowadays think, and like, you know, and their parents graduated from high school in the 90s or the 80s, and they probably think that their parents are just old fuddy-duddies. Believe me, it was around a lot longer before that. And who knows how much longer it was around prevalently before 1978 when I graduated from high school. I don't know. But it's been around a long time. And, you know, the young people, maybe you parents are not desirous of letting your kids know, hey, don't smoke marijuana because I used to smoke it and I had to stop smoking it because it's bad. Maybe you don't want to tell them that, but maybe you do. I mean, there may be a great value in you admitting to your kids, you know, I made that same mistake and it was not good and I regret it. And I have some gray in my hair now and I can share with you from experience that you shouldn't do it either because it's bad for you. So, yeah, check out that little book. And Cyrus, if you would get a link to that post, I'm sure people would appreciate that. Again, it's called, where is it? What is Wrong with Marijuana? 50 Questions and Answers. I'm going to take a break, but I'm coming right back. Here's the number, 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. And by the way, if you're paying for your kids' car payment and insurance and cell phone, and they're like 21, 22, 23, you're not doing them any favors. I'll tell you that. Our sponsor, Christendom College, offers our listeners access to free online classes at getprinciples.com/truth. Acclaimed philosopher Dr. John Cutteback is teaching a class now, Understanding Human Nature, at getprinciples.com/truth.
Tres, cuatro tacos. Don't forget the rice and beans on the plato. I like to eat, homie, yo no estoy flaco. Yeah, I'm chubby, pero I'm still guapo. Uno, dos, tres.
Patrick Madrid is on
Taco Tuesday,
coast to coast on Relevant Radio.
Taco Tuesday's my favorite day. Favorite. That's the reason why I'm more away. Pero I don't care, homie, let them hate. I'm just trying to eat another plate.
Another one.
Uno, yes.
Dos, tres, cuatro tacos. Don't forget the rice and beans.
Taco Tuesday is a fun day around here, that's for sure. How come we don't have a national Mexican food brand that underwrites this hour? We should.
No kidding.
We need, I don't know, Old El Paso or somebody to be underwriting this hour or this day of the week or this show. Think of all the taco ingredients we could move.
That's what I was just thinking of. Think of all the tacos they'd send us.
Oh, man.
For free. Free tacos. That's what I want.
Some Mexican food company owner could become fabulously wealthy just by advertising on this program. Just a thought, 888-914-9149. How about Christine now in Minneapolis? Hi, Christine.
Good morning.
Yes, good morning.
I have a quick question. My brother, who is baptized Catholic, he would like to marry a divorced Protestant. She was divorced, we were told, due to abuse. I'm wondering, is that allowed in the Catholic Church?
No, not as it stands. I mean, if she were to petition the church for a declaration of nullity, and if the church determined that her first marriage was null and therefore invalid, therefore she would be free to get remarried, then in that case, sure, he could pursue that. I don't think it's a good idea for Catholics and non-Catholics to get married. I know that there are some success stories, that's true. But more often than not, mixed marriages do not play out very well. And so just that aside, in terms of technically, would he be able to get married to her? The answer is yes. But she would need first to go through that process and find out from the Catholic Church whether or not there were grounds for this declaration of nullity. So unless he did that, then no, he would not be able to marry her.
Okay, and then how would she go about, or who does she contact to get the information to get that declaration of nullity if that's allowed?
It is, yeah. So what this would mean is, and most likely, I think she and he together would meet with the parish priest, so whatever his parish is, and then explain the situation. The priest would start the paperwork, so there's a paperwork process, and that would get sent into the tribunal at the diocese. And then the process would start, and people would be called as witnesses. And I know that traditionally it's been done in writing, where you'd fill out kind of a questionnaire of answers or of questions that you would give answers to. I know some dioceses, it seems now, they do it over the phone. So they would gather as much information, as much testimony as they could, and over time they would sift through the case, and there'd be somebody whose job it would be to try to defend this matrimonial bond and do everything possible to try to prove that the marriage was valid, and then let the evidence play out, and then there would be a determination that would be made, and they would notify her. So it wouldn't happen quickly, it wouldn't happen overnight, but it could happen faster than many people realize. And a book that's got a lot of information on that topic is called Annulments in the Catholic Church, Straight Answers to Tough Questions, and that's by a canon lawyer. His name is Ed Peters. And that would be a good book to give him or her, and that would give them the real specific technical information that they would need. But the parish priest can get all of that started for them if they sat down with him.
Excellent. Thank you for all the information. You have a great day.
Thanks, Christine. Thank you. Appreciate that. Let's go to Sarah now in Kansas City. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call, Patrick.
Happy to.
Recently, my father-in-law, who's a widower, came to visit us, and he wanted to bring his girlfriend, and my husband explained that would be wonderful. We have four bedrooms. to allow you to come visit us. And he said that he would sleep on the couch and his girlfriend would spend the time in one of the bedrooms. And what happened was they did, in fact, spend the time together in a shared bedroom. Mm-hmm. And it made us in quite a little bit of emotional turmoil inside. We were hospitable, and as they left, my husband said he wanted to let his dad know that that was inappropriate, and we felt complicit, and we didn't know what to do. And I said I was going to call you because I felt like saying anything would be dishonoring a parent, but we would rather not unmarried people share bedrooms in our house, children mm-hmm. or friends or otherwise, and we just wanted some advice.
Yeah, I can understand why you'd feel consternated at this. You weren't complicit in any sinful sense. You weren't really complicit in this because you already told him that you didn't want this to happen, and you made arrangements so that they could sleep in separate places. So there's nothing negative attaching to you or your husband in this issue. You're just the ones who see clearly what's going on, and it happened in your house. So I could see why you'd feel the way you do. So I don't really see a conflict here between honoring your father and mother and also being honest with somebody about what's permitted or not permitted. It's your home, after all, and you're not asking for anything unreasonable. And for that matter, you're trying to protect him from doing something sinful. And if he doesn't understand that, I mean, he's got to be fairly up in years. I mean, he's got to have enough life experience to know that if this isn't something that his hosts want to happen in their home, that they have a right to say that. So I think that in these circumstances, if you were to tell him, if you want to come back, great, you can't bring her back with you. Or if you want to come back, great, you can bring her with you, but you really have to abide by this rule, Dad, which is you can't sleep in the same room because you're not married. Now, if you get married at some point and it's a valid marriage, come on back. And we'll give you the guest suite all to yourselves. But in the meantime, it's not appropriate. It's immoral. And please respect that. Now, if he puts up a fuss or, you know, gets angry or, well, you're not dishonoring him. You're not violating the commandment of honoring your father and mother, because it doesn't honor your parent. I mean, you know this. I'm just saying it for the sake of it. But it doesn't honor your father-in-law to just go along to get along. That doesn't honor him. It honors him, really, to speak the truth in love and to say, hey, Dad, you taught me right from wrong. And how, isn't it strange that now I'm the one who has to stand up for what's right and wrong, and you're not standing up for it? That's weird. You know what I mean?
Yes. So do we wait until they want to come back, or
does my husband
say something now?
Well, I mean, it sounds like because it's a delicate situation now, maybe the thing to do is let it cool off. How often are they likely to want to come over? Is it a regular thing or once a year kind of thing?
A couple times a year.
Okay. So maybe as you're getting ready for the next holiday or the next visit, and it's still weeks away, and he's saying, hey, we'd like to come out and visit. And then your husband says, great, happy to have you, but I must insist that if you bring your girlfriend, she can't stay in the same room with you. And we don't want any monkey business. Like, we go to bed and then you get up in the middle of the night and sneak into her room. That's immature. he doesn't have to say that, but, you know, let's be adults about this, Dad. And if that's a rule that you can honestly abide by and not try to trick us, great. But if it's not something you can abide by and you're going to try to trick us again, then she can't come with you.
Thank you.
And then he's got time to decide whether he wants to do the right thing or not and make other plans if necessary. But you have every right, Sarah, to stand up for what you know to be right. You and your husband are doing the right thing, it seems to me.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome. I appreciate it. Cyrus, I'm noticing more and more. Well, I'll leave it at that. Thank you. Let us go to Anna now in Windham, Maine. Hello, Anna.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, for sure.
I just want to ask you what you think about Bethel Church. Have you ever heard about it?
There are a million and one Bethel churches. It's a common name in Baptist among Baptists. It's very common. So I don't know which one you're referring to. Is there a grouping of churches under that name?
Yes. Well, I was reading about it, and I know their founder is Bill Johnson. And my son, I moved here from California, and my son went to UCSB, so it's where he met his wife, and he got involved in it. And but it is to me, since I first talked to him about it, he was like, he didn't have time for family. Just
you talked to him about what, Anna?
About the church. He didn't have time for family. So it seems to me that their logo is a deer, which means free spirit.
But Anna, that all of those things being what they are, I don't know the first thing about this group. It's probably a conglomeration of churches, like maybe a non-denominational denomination. I just don't know. I don't know what to tell you about that. Now, if it's a Protestant group that espouses Protestant theology of whatever variety, Baptist, for example, I could maybe help with some specific things like that, but I don't know anything about this group as such.
It's in Redding, California, and they're being accused of being a cult, but they deny it. And they tell them, just don't drink the Kool-Aid. People that don't like them over there, I read about it. But I don't know. It seems like my son, they have like healing rooms, he said, and he's going to go next weekend for the healing room because he's been having like suicidal thoughts and just stress trying to finish his master's, and his wife is a little bipolar, and it's just I don't know what to say mm-hmm. to them anymore. So,
well, sounds like you're a good mom, you care about your son, you want to do something to help, but you're probably not going to be able to do much of anything other than give him good advice. And one bit of good advice would be for him to get some counseling. I mean, if he's got depression, and if there's, if there are other things like that that are part of the bigger picture, not to mention this odd group that he's associated with. And he was raised Catholic, yes, I presume, right?
Yes. Until he went to UCSB, he got into that. And I already suggested, he went to see a doctor. He's been in the emergency room twice. And, the suicidal thoughts scare me because his wife said that he was trying to hurt the kids and hurt himself.
So, Anna, this is way beyond the problem with this church. I mean, that just makes the problem worse. But this is something that's going to require professional assistance. So
but that's the thing. They won't. They think that they're totally different. They think that God is going to heal them in the healing rooms, that God has given them that power.
Well, then if there's any indication, you said violence a second ago, if there's any indication that there's violence going on, that's a crime, you get law enforcement involved. And if they get involved, then they start making decisions regardless of what he may or may not want. If there's a psychiatric problem, people can be committed. No shame in that. And if he needs to be committed for a time, a long weekend or a week or something longer to be evaluated, so be it. Better that people get evaluated and get the help they need than to, go berserk and do something terrible. We all know about those things. So that would be, I know it's difficult advice to give, but if you've reached the point where it's now breaking out in violence, you need to call the police. I'm sorry, Anna. I'll be right back.